Glad you remember that. So she filed a complaint with the...
Yeah, unfair labor.
Unfair labor practice.
Michigan Employment Relations Commission. And so a hearing was scheduled. And then subpoenas were issued for some of the people in the Natural Science Department, the old guard, who had acted to deny her reappointment. That was a faculty decision in natural science. So we wanted to subpoena some of those people. And I remember I had two subpoenas to serve. One was a guy whose name I can forget now. But I went to his house, and as I was walking toward the door, I could see through the living room window, I could see this guy sitting in there. And he must have seen me, because when I rang the doorbell, his teenage son came to the door, and I said, I'd like to see your father. And, oh, he's not here. He apparently ducked out the back. And the other one was to serve as subpoena on the department head, a guy named Manny Hackle. He's in the med school now. I think he's an expert on blood. Mm-hmm. And he's really a nice guy, but I had a picture of him because I held him responsible for what happened to Murray and Van Tassel. Mm-hmm. And I served a subpoena on him. He didn't want to accept it, so he threw it down on the desk, and we were in an office with the door closed, and outside were about half a dozen secretaries typing away. Mm-hmm. And when they saw me come in, they stopped typing to hear what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I'm standing in front of this guy's desk, and at some point I said, if you don't accept that subpoena, God damn it, I'm going to come over there and I'm going to ram it down your throat. I didn't know whether to be humiliated when I reflected on that. Now I feel embarrassed that uh-huh. I did. And we're friendly now. Mm-hmm. He's a bigger man than I. Well, yeah, he's a bigger man than I am. I have no reason not to like him. He has a good reason not to like me, though. But, you know, the passage of time really does heal wounds. I think we have evidence of that.
Interesting. How was it that you mentioned the state news and you mentioned the effort that to deny you being able to publish in it? Does that lead at all into your writing letters? So do you remember when your first, or ultimately your column in the state news? Why don't we talk about that a little bit?
I never thought of writing to the state news. As a matter of fact, just the thought of it had a chilling effect on the idea of doing it, because when you're on the faculty, you think of publishing something, and you want to be absolutely meticulous in your research and be sure that what you're saying is accurate and supported by evidence and that kind of thing. It's a painful experience sometimes. Mm-hmm. So the idea of writing a letter to the state news or a newspaper struck me as a pretty formidable job, because I wanted to be absolutely certain of the truth of what I was saying and mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
That reflected your background as a economist and as a scholar.
Yeah, right. Because I had published a couple of books by mm-hmm. this time. Mm-hmm. And I'd had people go over it and correct statements I've made and put in the margin, you know, what evidence you have for this kind of thing. And in fact, one book was gone over by, I had published already, by lawyers for the publisher, who said, can you document this and so on. And I learned, this was the first book about the longshore industry, and I'd make the statement that some official of the East Coast Longshoremen's Union was a criminal. Mm-hmm. And the lawyer would say, what's your basis for that? I said, well, he's been arrested, you know, 15 times. Was he convicted? Well, I'd say, no. Well, then he's not a criminal. You can't say he's a criminal. You can say he's been arrested. Well, you can learn from those experiences.
Yeah.
So it seemed like a pretty formidable thing to be doing. And so I never even gave any serious consideration to writing to the state news until the Schiff case came up, and Hannah made that statement about the three communist-trained agitators. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I wrote an outraged letter or point of view to the state news, fairly long, expressing my outrage at the fact that the president would engage in red baiting this way, etc. And I showed it to Adams, and he said, well, two comments. He says, one, it's way too long. Two, it's the kind of thing nobody will finish reading. It's too deadly serious. What you should do is poke fun at the idea of a big institution quaking at the thought of three undergraduates threatening the institution. Well, in those days, what we now call Beijing was Peking. So I titled this thing, Three Pied Pipers from Peking. I thought that was pretty clever.
Oh, the alliteration.
I still think it was pretty clever. Now it'd have to be Three Lousy Bastards from Beijing, I suppose. But anyway, I laid the lash on Hannah. I think I even called him a fascist in this thing. And they published that. And so that encouraged me. And so I started writing points. That was 65. I started writing points of view. And I wrote about these cases that led to the grievance procedure.
Mm-hmm.
And the Schiff case led to the Academic Freedom Report, which gives students rights they have in a grievance procedure. There's a whole company of people over in the student union building, or student services building,
mm-hmm.
who monitor student judiciary meetings and so on, try to ensure that people enjoy due process, etc. That all grew out of the Schiff case. So I started writing about these incidents. And the time came, I think it was 1971, when I was writing. They would always be called points of view, and then at the bottom it would say Professor LaRue, economics or something. And they had regular columnists on the staff as they do now. I think much better than the ones they have now. But anyway, a columnist, this of course would be a student, would have a photograph and the person's name in large type. And the significance of that, to me, was that if somebody's scanning the editorial page or the op-ed page and you see a picture of somebody there and a name, you're more likely to read that if you've read the person before than if you don't have the picture and the name. So I went to the opinion page editor and I said, look, I said, I'm writing about one a week, points of view. Why don't you make me a columnist? Then I'll have my picture and the name in big type. Oh, he said, well, the policy of the paper is you have to be a student to be a columnist. So I said, if I become a student, will you make me a columnist? Well, he said, I have to check that out with the editor-in-chief. And he came back and he said, yeah. So I enrolled as a grad student, and it was the damnedest experience. I had to do all the things that anybody else would do enrolling as a grad student. I had to get my undergraduate transcript,
mm-hmm.
which revealed to anybody who saw it that I had been a goof-off as an undergrad. Then I got my Yale transcript, which showed that I did pretty well. Well, for instance, on my undergraduate transcript, down in the lower left corner was a little space, couldn't have been more, but not much bigger than maybe two postage stamps could have covered that little space. That was so covered with on academic probation, off academic probation, they went over on the back side. So George Bush hasn't got anything on me. I should say President-elect Bush.
So that became part of the university record.
And I got these letters just addressed, dear applicant, you know, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But they decided to admit me on the strength of my Yale.
You don't think it gave a chuckle to the people in the administration that reviewed your application?
Nobody ever mentioned that to me.
They must have probably scrutinized it.
They must have thought it was really weird. So then, what would I take? See, I had to sign up for a course. I thought, well, I'll take Adams's course. Maybe I could embarrass him or something. But you can't take a course in your own department.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Certain, so I think people violate that sometimes, mm-hmm. but that's what I've told. So, I'm trying to figure out what course I'll take. I got a call from a woman over in the business school, Mary, I can't remember her name now. Anyway, she was the head of the office administration, which had a course in typing.
Typing.
And she said, do you know how to type? And I said, no, I don't. She said, well, do you mean, how do you do those columns? I said, I write them out and turn them in that way. Well, she said, why don't you take a course in typing, then you can type those columns.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, would you admit me to your department? Sure. So I took a course in typing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 71, mm-hmm. somewhere in there. And it was a great experience. There were, I think, about 30 glamorous looking co-eds and one man, undergraduate, and me. Mm-hmm. So he and I sat together. And God, I was so terrible at typing that the only way I could get I think I got a 1.5 in the course, and that was the generosity of the instructor. But I would go up after class each day and compliment him on his teaching techniques and the use of graphic aids.
Beat your way to a 1.5.
I attended faithfully, but except for one day, and he asked this undergraduate who sat next to me, "You know where Dr. LaRue is?" They always called me Dr. LaRue. I don't know if he had a doctor. I don't imagine he would to teach typing, but mm-hmm. he was a pretty effective teacher, I thought. He says, "You don't think Dr. LaRue's out on Grand River in that anti-war protest? We were out there overnight." Mm-hmm. And this guy says, "Yeah, I'm pretty sure he is." And this guy went, "Oh, I don't approve of that." So what? Having heard that he had inquired about that, I tried to make it up to him by flattering him that this worked, because I didn't deserve that 1.5. But I did go every day. Mm-hmm. And I did learn how to... I still
the keyboard.
Hunt and peck, but I could, you know, make columns and do mm-hmm. things like that.
Mm-hmm. You remember, what was the speed you were typing at the end?
The less said about that, the better.
Oh.
I don't remember. Mm-hmm. If I ever heard it, I repress it. But I do remember one time, I couldn't figure out what I was supposed to be doing, and I turned to this other guy. I said, "What the hell am I supposed to do with this question or something?" And he sort of ignored me or something. Then the instructor came down and he said, "Dr. LaRue, we're taking a test." I hadn't even known that.
So this allowed you to be a columnist.
I would write every week, including the summer. I must have written 350 columns, because I went from 71 to 89. That's almost 20 years. And I usually taught in the summertime to augment my modest salary.
Mm-hmm. Did you start with any guiding principles on your own columns?
No,
you mentioned using
that's
humor.
That's interesting. You noticed in that introduction or whatever it is mm-hmm. by Adams, I just started doing that. I don't know why. And it turned out to have very substantial benefits, because after I'd been writing those columns in that satirical Mr. Dooley fashion, or Peter Finley Dunn, rather, mm-hmm. fashion, I was trying to rewrite my book about Harry Bridges, and I'd been rebuffed by publishers all over the place, including a leftist who was the dean of editors in New York at that time, working for Alfred Knopf, and I can't remember the guy's name right now. But he wrote to me. I sent him the manuscript. I had an agent. I think the editor of The Nation magazine, whom I had talked to somehow or other, suggested an agent to me. So you could say I had an agent. And she had shown the manuscript to this guy at the at Alfred Knopf. And he rejected it. And I think in a letter he said, "You got a great story there, but the way you've written it, I wouldn't know where to start editing it." I'd talk about feeling crushed, you know. I figured, I'm going to go and talk to this guy. So I went to New York to talk to him. And he just repeated what he had said. And so I think I must have rewritten the damn manuscript at least 8 times. But when I got down to the last, you know, number 7 or number 8, I was writing these in this satirical way. And I loosened up my writing in the Bridges book, and people said to me, "You know, I can hear you talking when I read that book," which I think is a compliment mm-hmm. in nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So it really benefited me doing the column. And I also used to wonder, is it absurd for a professor to write a regular column in a student paper? You know, would you be looked upon as sort of strange or something? But then I realized, the state news goes to the legislature, goes to all government departments, et cetera. You go into a supermarket in town now and you see a state news stand there. Okay. And all kinds of people have come up to me at various times and Fidelow and so on, and I have no idea who they are, but they've read that damn column, including legislators and government officials. So there's a huge audience for that state news. Mm-hmm. Now, at one point, I think I'd been writing for about 10 years or so. State News commissioned somebody in the journalism department to do a survey of readership. And they, among other things, the report which emerged from that said, the report said the first part of the paper students turn to is the comics. Then they go to sports. Then they go to Lash's column.
I was, you were singled out.
So I had reason to believe, here's some evidence that it was widely read.
Mm-hmm. Were there any, obviously you collected your, some you considered your best articles in the book called Lashing Out, The Best of Lash LaRue.
Yeah.
And you published this book.
That's self-published.
Self-published, yeah. Uh-huh.
There was a woman in the journalism department named Carol Eberle,
uh-huh,
who was recommended to me as somebody who could help me get a book published, and she advised me about getting a printer and getting somebody to bind it, and uh-huh, et cetera. I have a feeling I don't acknowledge any debt to her in the damn thing, but I sure should have. Uh-huh. Now, that photograph on the front, That was a photograph in connection with one of the columns, and some people were upset over that. See, mm-hmm. Now what I have in the picture is I have a combat infantry badge, which is a serious medal.
Mm-hmm.
You notice when you see people like Colin Powell and whatnot wearing mm-hmm. a uniform.
Mm-hmm. High. That's not giving out in Cracker Jack box.
I think you had to be in combat for 30 days to mm-hmm. get that medal. Mm-hmm. And they always put it at the top of mm-hmm. You could have five layers in it at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And the other medal is a good conduct medal. Mm-hmm. In 3 years in the Army, I think mm-hmm. I got one of those. You're supposed mm-hmm. to get them every year if you're a good boy.
Uh-huh.
And then I've got the flag upside down. See, that's supposed to convey America is in distress. Well, it was during the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And this cap, which is like a Legion cap,
mm-hmm.
that's Vietnam veterans against the war.
Mm-hmm.
I was really proud of that picture. That was taken by the man who supervised photographers for the state news. He's now in Detroit on either the news or the Free Press.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember the guy's name. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, what are you going to charge me for that? Oh, he said, you couldn't afford to pay what I have to charge you for that. I'll do that for free.
Uh-huh.
And then on the back, the back cover, you see me from behind as if I'm disappearing back into the book. That was his idea. I thought it was pretty clever.
In that design. Yeah. And this picture of you in uniform, or a uniform, that appeared in the column regularly?
No, not regularly. That was a lot of fun. I'd go over, see, I would hand deliver my column to the newsroom. And the opinion page editor would read it if he liked it. He'd summon a cartoonist or a photographer, and I have several cartoons that were done to go with the column,
mm-hmm.
and photographs. So I remember one time, I don't know what the subject of the column was, but I went to great effort to find a World War I German helmet
with the little spike.
Yeah. I found out that spike has a function. You turn it one way if the weather's cold, and it shuts off air
uh-huh.
in or out. Turn it the other way, and it allows air to circulate on the top of your head mm-hmm. inside the helmet. Mm-hmm.
Rather than just decorative.
Yeah.
And you appeared also, obviously, in Hawaiian shirt or...
I adopted that Hawaiian shirt because until 1970, I was the model of a university prof. I always wore a suit, bow tie.
That's where Walter Adams wrote, "You look like a banker."
Yeah.
You mentioned
that. Yeah, that's right. And then I used to wear tweeds at one time.
Uh-huh.
And as I got older, it has to do with your metabolism, I suppose. I would notice that I'd perspire when I was teaching, and I'd take my jacket off, and then I'd untie my tie, and the collar was choking me. And I discovered that people in physics and math taught in open-collar shirts, no jackets. And I thought, if those guys can do it, I can do it. And I was divorced in 1970, so I didn't have anybody to tell me put on their suit. Mm-hmm. So I just stopped wearing a suit in 1970, and I've never worn one since. And, but I did it for comfort. Mm-hmm. Well, in the course of doing my book about bridges, I spent a lot of time in Hawaii because the union organized people in the sugar and pineapple industries over there, and they've had a tremendous impact on the politics of Hawaii, mm-hmm. which is now a democratic state and probably has a body of laws that are more progressive than any other state. And it used to be a colony, you know, with a governor appointed by the president and mm-hmm. so on. Well, that's largely due to the impact of the union organize all those workers. So I'd go over there and spend a month at a time or 2 weeks and so on. I'd buy Hawaiian shirts, and when I was grievance officer, the woman who worked in the office with me said, you buy some material on the next trip and I'll make some shirts for you. So she made four shirts. Mm-hmm. The first, you can appreciate this, the first one she made was too small. Mm-hmm. And she underestimated my bulk, I guess. So we discarded that one. Then she made some really nice ones. And so I figured I'm really comfortable wearing a shirt like that. Uh-huh. And I stand out as different, too.
The colorful Hawaiian-style shirt.
One student wrote on an evaluation one time, the very first day I came to class, I felt right at home because I come from Hawaii, and here's the prof. And I'd wear them the year round. In a day like this, where the temperature outside is about 15, I'd come in with a Hawaiian shirt and a warm coat. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Arrive on a bicycle.
Yeah. I didn't know there was any connection with your research and with Harry Bridges. The connection between the shirt.
And if it hadn't been for spending all that time in Hawaii, I never would have hit upon the idea of those Hawaiian shirts.
Well, it makes sense. Did faculty give you any flack about that? Or
you know, that's interesting. My department head was an active reserve lieutenant in the Navy. And he was a very straight sort of person. I think two different times he said to me, pretty informal, aren't we? And I said, yeah. That was that. Well, what the hell can a, you're an associate department head, aren't you?
That's right.
What can you do with some guy who insists on wearing a shirt?
Dress code, yeah.
Yeah.
Just so it's clean.
Yeah. Well, I washed them and actually had to iron them because they were cotton. So they were always clean.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Now I noticed in the econ department, which I'd be wearing these Hawaiian shirts, I never got any criticism in student evaluations for my failure to live up to some tacit dress code. Mm-hmm. But I noticed young faculty members would leave a tie and a jacket in their office. So that when they went into class, they'd put on the tie and the jacket. When they come back, they'd take it off and hang it up. Mm-hmm. And I asked one of them, why do you do that? Why do you insist on wearing a tie and a jacket? Well, he said, I got criticism in my student evaluations. You should dress the way a prof is expected to dress. I never got anything like that. There's another guy, it's due for retirement now, mm-hmm. who always wore a suit. And he said to me, you know, you ought to wear a tie and a jacket. I said, why? Well, he said, to show respect for the students. And this is a guy who would never speak to a student. He'd always tell the student who wanted to talk about his exam, see my TA.
Oh.
I mean, literally, he would not talk to a student. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of respect he had mm-hmm. for him. I figured the students will respect you if there's some positive correlation between what you talk about, especially in a field like labor relations, mm-hmm. and what you do. So to me, in a way, wearing that Hawaiian shirt and blue jeans, they were tattered sometimes, and I had a pair of tennis shoes I particularly liked, and they got to the point where I had to take duct tape to hold them together. But I figured if a student would ever ask me, why do you do that, I'd say, because I want to demonstrate to you mm-hmm. that how you dress and how you look is irrelevant to teaching, and you can... Not only that, but once you get tenure, you can survive without having to meet somebody's tacit, especially if it's a tacit dress code. Mm-hmm. I had one student, an African-American student, who came to class wearing a three-piece suit every time. Mm-hmm. And I asked him one time, how come you wear a three-piece suit? Oh, he says, I work at Ford World Headquarters in Dearborn, and I drive over here for this class, and I drive right back. And when I'm there, I have to wear a suit. This poor guy gave me a book by John Malloy, Dress for Success. I said to him, you know, you give that to the wrong guy. I said, I am a success by my lights. I'm right where I want to be in life. At the end of the term, I had no, that's the only conversation I had with this guy. I had TAs who read exams, and I would make up the grades with one of my TAs. We came to this poor guy's name, and I think he got a D, or a 1 point or something. Mm-hmm. He just didn't have it when it came to writing exams. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I was torn there for a while. He was trying to help me by giving me dress for success. And I rewarded with a 1.0 grade. Yeah.
Did you, were there any of your columns that, did any of the legislatures talk with you about, or that you remember, or you just mentioned that they read them?
They just said they read them and enjoyed them. That was all. They didn't talk about any particular one.
Did you have a problem where people would take what you wrote in a satirical sense, where they took it literally? Was that ever a problem?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, people regular readers would know your style, and I remember reading some of the columns when I was a student.
But there were people who took them seriously. Uh-huh. I was even told by some students that when they first got here as freshmen, they read those things for a year, thinking I was a wild-eyed reactionary. Mm-hmm. And then they finally caught on it was satire, but it took them a year. We had an Iranian grad student in economics who, I don't know how it came about, but I made a suggestion to him that he was misusing English grammar or something. He said, what would you know about proper grammar? He said, I read what you write in the sea.
The malapropisms and
I was trying to portray myself. My intent was to portray myself as a venal, semi-literate prof, of whom there are some in the profession around the country. I've met them, in various universities, a few of them here, too. We don't have any more.
Stuffed shirts,
yeah. There are a lot of faculty members whose grammar is deplorable, and they inflict that on students, Here they are, role models for students. So that's what I was trying to convey. That's the kind of guy I was, for laughs.
The creative writing aspect about your column seems to be an important one. Did you see it as an outlet for any of that?
I don't know if this is what you're thinking about, but I was told by several different profs who were teaching writing that they used my columns. Now, whether they used them as the sort of thing to avoid or or as examples of satire, or how they used them, I don't know. But the way they described it, I did have the impression it was used in a positive way from my standpoint. Mm-hmm. Is that what you were saying?
Yes. I mean, obviously it's part of a scholar's outlet. Some people have traditional publishing, and then there's also the creative writing, and obviously looking at your career as a teacher and as an author, you'd have to consider the columns as an important part of your body of work, I would think. And in terms of the creativity and the thought that you put behind it, it seems like that is an important aspect in understanding your contributions to the university, really.
I would rewrite those columns several times. Uh-huh. The first draft would be the kind of thing you'd expect a professor to write, proper grammar and serious tone and all that kind of thing. The second draft would be started loosening up and so on. Then by the time I get to the fourth, my grammar is deplorable, and you'd have that scene at the beginning to catch their interest, where I was doing something utterly absurd. Mm-hmm. That just sort of evolved without my thinking about doing it in a conscious way.
Uh-huh. Did you talk with any of your colleagues, like Walter Adams or others, about ideas of relating to columns, or did they just come to you, or
they just actually? I had a I have a friend who was assigned to me as a teaching assistant in 1967. Mm-hmm. And somehow he and I formed a partnership in which he wanted to be a silent partner. He didn't want to attract attention to himself, whereas I was delighted to attract attention to myself. And he and I would get together once a week, and we'd, before he was married, we'd have dinner, and then we'd start consuming whiskey and water and start talking about ideas for a column. And he was the one who suggested these zany openings in which I portrayed myself as, you know, a total idiot. And I would balk at that sometimes, but then he would prevail. And the time came when we'd be meeting and we'd put away so much booze while we're talking about the ideas for the column and way to say things and laugh up a storm as the evening progressed. Next morning, I couldn't remember what the hell we talked about. So I've gotten the habit of writing down a skeletal a column, mm-hmm. and then the next morning, that would remind me of what...
That's interesting.
So I owe him a lot. If that was worthy enterprise, he's entitled to a lot of credit, but he didn't want to be identified with it.
Mm-hmm. Did you end up selling many of the books, lashing out?
I wish you hadn't asked that question.
Oh, sorry.